Good morning, everyone. Happy Fog Day. I promise to endeavor to not make anything clearer. So I was looking out the window upstairs in the office, just now waiting to come down, and I was watching robins go from branch to branch on the oak tree in the backyard, and I was thinking about the talk, and I realized this is improv. Every Sunday, we call this thing Dharma talk. That's what we call this, but it's actually improv. We co-create this, don't we? I wouldn't be here doing this if you weren't here. You wouldn't be here doing this if I wasn't here. We co-create this, right? And it takes you to create this talk. It takes me to create this talk. It takes the room. It takes the robins. Your great-great-great-grandmother. Your great-great-great-grandkids. Bodhidharma. Are all co-creating this talk in the moment. So the talk that I wrote is not the talk that I'll give. It never is. That's impossible. And the talk that I offer you today is not the one that you're going to receive. It is not the one you're going to hear. It's not the one you're going to carry with you. So we are collaborators this morning. We are cohorts. We are co-conspirators. We're in cahoots. Isn't that cool? We've decided to come together and do a performance art project called Dharma Talk. So enjoy. We can't engineer enlightenment by ourselves. It is done unto us. We can't engineer enlightenment by ourselves. It is done unto us. I like that a lot. Richard Rohr said that. And I think it ties in with what I'm going to attempt to talk about today, or at least circle around, or at least obscure. On your programs is... actually, what is on your programs? Thank you. Oh, stop thinking of Bodhidharma, it says. Still, Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. Thank you, Tammy. So, my jumping off place here is a koan, actually the verse, as part of a commentary on a koan. And sometimes this is presented as a koan, sometimes it's just presented as a story, but it's familiar to a lot of us in Zen circles. Most of you, I would assume, would know it. The story, in short, is that of Bodhidharma, who is said to be the person who brought Zen from India to China. He's kind of the father of Zen. Probably a largely fictional character, perhaps an entirely fictional character, perhaps an amalgamation of different personalities at that time. We don't actually know. But what this is referring to, and I'll read you the entirety of the verse that Secho wrote as part of his commentary on this case. It's from the Blue Cliff Record, for those of you who are into koans, and it's case number one. So this is the origins. This is going back to origin stories about Zen. And the famous conversation that Bodhidharma had with Emperor Wu, where he essentially explains the teaching of emptiness, the ideal of not knowing. Bodhidharma also comes across as, to me he comes across as bordering on antisocial. Not exactly the friendliest guy in the world. There's a good reason that, like, Benton is our greeter and not Bodhidharma. I don't think he'd make a very good greeter. Very cranky, long beard, big earring. There's a really good reason. He wouldn't let anybody in the door unless they had cut off at least one limb to show their sincerity. Probably worked really well back in that era, but now that's seen as a little a little extreme. It'd be a good... try it out and see how it fits, sort of. So the verse I'll read to you. The verse that Setchell wrote in response to... actually Bodhidharma as a figure, as a symbol of the teaching of Zen, the doctrine of emptiness, the ideal of not knowing. The holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? No knowing. Inevitably, the thorns and briars springing up. Secretly by night he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. So many years gone by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. A master looks around. Is the ancestor there? Yes, bring him to me, and he can wash my feet. So that's our verse. I'll talk a little bit about it, and then I'll just wander. The holy teaching, emptiness. There's a lot of different versions of this conversation that Bodhidharma is said to have had with the emperor, and a lot of you have heard it many times, so I'm going to try to spend as little time on this as possible. But for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, I want to at least catch you up. The great Zen teacher, the great Buddhist master, the great Indian sage Bodhidharma comes to China and gathers a reputation, and the emperor goes to see him. Essentially, to gain his approval is one of the ways of interpreting their conversation. But anyway, he goes to see him. What's the utmost truth of your holy teaching? What's the essence of what it is you're here to do? And he just says, emptiness. Nothing holy, emptiness. Which is a kind of unusual answer, probably. Makes a lot of sense to us Zen students, but at the time, that's pretty shocking. Who are you? Who are you to say this? I don't know. Or no knowing. It's a really evasive response, isn't it? Again, he would not make a good greeter. Oh, is this Zen Center? I don't know. Am I welcome or not? But emptiness comes up a lot, of course, in Zen teaching and Mahayana Buddhism a lot. The teaching of emptiness is, in essence, the lack of abiding, lack of abiding nature. The nature of reality being dynamic change. And this teaching helps us to recognize how we impose what we think of as pattern or structure or order on a system that largely has none of those things. And it helps us, of course, we need to imagine that we are fixed selves to some degree. We need to imagine that the car we're going to drive home in or the bus we're going to take home or the bike we're going to get on and ride is the same bike we left a couple hours ago. That's helpful for us. That's what Tim calls a useful fiction. But emptiness invites us to something a little more free than that, to acknowledge that the nature of dynamic change, the nature of reality, allows for constant movement, constant ventilation, constant and infinite numbers of choices that we get to make around doing something that is potentially compassionate, potentially helpful, potentially awakening for ourselves, that nothing is in fact locked, nothing is in fact frozen, including self, including life, including death. So he's explaining this, and Bodhidharma, at least in my way of understanding, in this brief verse, and of course this is a verse, even being asked, so what's the core of your teaching? Oh, emptiness. And who is this who stands before me? I don't know. There's no knowing. Even that, he realizes, oh, I've said too much. This is going to make trouble. As soon as we say something, we make trouble, don't we? So I'm going to just do nothing but make trouble sitting here. I encourage you to not believe anything I'm saying. I encourage you to never believe anything anybody sitting on a brown cushion says. My God, don't do that. Don't do that. But notice how your breath feels in your body when somebody sitting on a brown cushion is giving a Dharma talk. That might be a good place to start. I don't think we get to know what that is. It's too dynamic to be known. So, he says in his little verse here, inevitably the thorns and briars springing up. The thorns and briars springing up because Bodhidharma has spoken. And this is cool. I like that Buddhism and Zen especially acknowledges the incompleteness and the imperfection of language to convey reality. I really like that. I appreciate that. We use language all the time. I mean, I get that. And it is funny that a tradition that puts as much emphasis as Zen does on silence and on not knowing and on the incompleteness of language involves thousands of hours of Dharma talks and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. You know, we acknowledge, oh, this is a thing we have to do. I have to try to use symbols. I have to try to use symbols to connect with you. Language is just symbols, right? I have to try to use symbols. But I appreciate that the symbol I show you is going to be different than the symbol you receive. You know, the way you hear my words is going to be different than the way they're showing up in my heart. The way they're showing up in my heart right now is different than how they felt when I wrote them down. The symbol of the sunrise, when you see that sunrise and when I see that sunrise, two different things. And so we get caught. And Zen acknowledges the imperfection of language to carry something like reality. We always have to reduce experience into symbols to try to convey it. And it's good to do that. But it's also good to remember this is just a symbol that's fixed and represents an experience. It refers to something, but it isn't that thing. That's why none of this stuff is really locked in Zen, that no knowing is held up as an idea, because the truth that Bodhidharma felt is different than the truth Bodhidharma can say, and the truth Bodhidharma could say is different than the truth of my life. So it's important for me to, wow, I want to study him. He was deeply wise, deeply compassionate, spent years and years and years doing this meditation. There's something there for me. But it would be foolish for me to just memorize something he said and acknowledge it as some sort of locked-in truth about reality. That would be foolish, wouldn't it? It doesn't quite work. So the misunderstanding and complications of teachings is what we're talking about here. The briars, the thorns and briars. So there's a lovely poem by Daio Koshuki about Zen itself, and three of the lines that I love. I just love these lines. I did a big calligraphy piece of them once just to get closer to them. You know, if you write something down, you feel a little closer to it than if you just hear it. And you spend a lot of time writing it in a specific way, you start feeling closer to it than even if you were normally writing it. It's just a way of kind of being close to something. Daio Koshuki says, "Wishing to entice the blind, the Buddha has playfully let words escape his golden mouth. Heaven and earth are ever since filled with entangling briars." That is fantastic. That makes me feel really good. Wishing to entice the blind. He has to say something. He has to say something. I have to say something. But as soon as I say something, heaven and earth are ever since filled with entangling briars. So it's cool that he uses the word playfully. The Buddha has playfully let words. Let's remember that this is play. Even the Dharma. You know? The reason this is important is because otherwise we would argue over which translation of the Dhammapada was real, what the Buddha really said and what he didn't, and we'd argue with each other. And maybe we'd hit each other. Maybe we'd kill each other. If that sounds silly to you sitting in this room, pay attention. It's not very silly. We forget play. So, Secho, which is great, this is so Zen, in his commentary on the koan about the great founder Bodhidharma, the unassailable holy person, says, stop thinking of him. Like, for God's sake, let it go. He's gone. He's gone. Stop thinking of him. Still, Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain after so many years. What they're referring to here is, there's a line here I've read, secretly by night he crossed the river. When Bodhidharma is said to have been done with his teaching, there's a few different versions. He vanishes into the ether. He crosses the river back into India. Some say he disappeared into the wilds of China. It depends on what version you like. But either way, he leaves. He's done doing what it is he needs to do, and he crosses the river to whatever is next. And he crosses the river on a single reed. He just stands on a reed, and it carries him across the river. Right. So Jesus walking on water, he did not have a monopoly, evidently. There's other people who get to do that. But he leaves. And all the people could not bring him back. I'm just reminded of how much time I have spent in my life trying to bring people back. people that left by choice, people that left not by choice, teachers, family, loved ones. How naturally we do that as humans. How naturally we long for that which isn't to be that which is. And how much suffering that gives us. And of course, it's natural. There's actually, I find a strange sort of poignant beauty in that, actually. But I don't know that it's a place I'd want to live for very long. And our poet here, Secho, is encouraging us to acknowledge he has left, the years have gone by, stop thinking of him. Why? Because he goes on to say, the very next line, a gentle breeze pervades the universe. It's a strange response, isn't it? All the people couldn't bring him back. So many years gone by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. It almost seems like a random insertion. But I kind of get how, in the flow of this, the gentle breeze is happening now. And it pervades the universe. It pervades everything. The thing you want isn't gone. Bodhidharma here. Gentle breeze here. This is what's happening. This is where your freedom is. The gentle breeze is an image of liberative experience of freedom, lightness, possibility, dynamic change. That's what happens right now. That's why this talk is so collaborative. That's why we get to be cohorts today. Whoosh. Whoosh. This is the one that's arising. This isn't the one I wrote. It's not the one you'll listen to later. The gentle breeze pervades the universe. It's just funny how much we need to be reminded of that. I know I do. I need to be reminded over and over and over by my teachers, living, dead, or yet to be born, this is it. This is it. This is it. This is it. Not before, not after, not a long time ago, not later. A gentle breeze. So this is Zazen. I think of this as being Zazen. This is our sitting practice, our meditation practice, our emptying that we do, our emptying of self, emptying the self of the self. Our practice is said to be the Dharma gate of ease and bliss, because it can pacify. It can pacify your troubled heart mind. The practice of sitting upright can ease your troubled heart mind, or it can show you your troubled heart mind. Your troubled heart mind gets a chance to show up in Zazen. That's kind of the same as ease in a way. Hello, suffering, I see you now. There's a chance we can be close. There's a chance my kind attention can begin to transform you. If I don't feel you or know that you're there, I can't do anything. Your suffering's invisible to me. So Zazen's kind of brilliant, isn't it? Here it is. Showing up, I get to see you more intimately, and I also get to ease you, and it's also not me doing it. I'm not the one who gets enlightened. This is done unto me by, I don't know, it doesn't matter what, by everything. How could it be otherwise? Wow. All I got to do is get out of the way. That's actually not that hard. That's actually not that hard to do. We have to do it over and over, but that's actually okay. You just notice how you show up, and you just sort of, later, please, later, you can sit over there for now, but right now, a gentle breeze that can show us our suffering and can help to transform our suffering. As long as our awareness is kind, as long as we stay in that kind place, right? That kind, soft place. So Secho goes on to say another thing that I think is fabulous, probably because it borders on blasphemy to me. There's really no such thing as blasphemy in Zen. I don't know what blasphemy would do. I don't know what that would be in Zen, actually. We seem to go out of our way to say, so like, if you see the Buddha, kill him. Oh, wow, I'm not sure you're supposed to say that. Yeah, well, too late. It's, again, to keep us from fixing. To keep us from fixing. To grabbing on to the one thing. The true thing. So, Secho says about Bodhidharma, bring him to me and he can wash my feet. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And actually, the more time I spend with this line, the more I realize, oh, that's actually not blasphemy at all. This is an offering of great compassion. You know, these funny old Zen stories, when you start reading koans, or, well, it shows up in the Japanese tradition too, but especially these early Chinese records that seem to make no sense at all. There's one way of understanding it, and that works, a conventional way, like, well, he can wash my feet. You know? But there's also another thing folded in there that totally takes the blasphemy away. Right? Bodhidharma Bodhidharma is this founder of Zen. He's a cranky old guy. He spends 9 years in a cave facing the wall. Depending on which myth you believe, his limbs fall off from all of the meditations. So he has to roll from town to town to give teaching. He's so frustrated with his own drowsiness, he tears off his own eyelids so as to stay awake and throws the eyelids out the cave door, and hence tea grows. This is science, folks. This is science. So, I'm telling you the truth. So, wow, he's an unbelievably cranky old guy. And Setro is actually giving him the opportunity to serve him with kindness and compassion. Would you like to wash my feet? Have you ever washed anybody's feet? Has anybody in this room ever? Oh, a number of hands. Good. Isn't it beautiful? It's actually incredibly beautiful. It's a deeply tender thing to do, to wash somebody's feet. Out of reverence, out of respect, out of love, not as a, you know, debasement. That's not at all what's going on here. And to offer somebody the opportunity to wash yours is actually a sign of great humility. And it's one of those moments where we kind of forget and we kind of can't tell who's offering what to whom. Right? To give somebody the opportunity to wash your feet is deeply intimate. Right? It's deeply intimate. And it is humbling. And to do it, to get down on your knees and to put somebody's feet in a basin and care for them, wow, that's humbling too, and it's deeply beautiful. Isn't that interesting? So he's like, I want to go into communion with this guy. He can wash my feet. I'm actually giving him a gift. And actually, he's giving me a gift. Whoosh. No more separation between him and Bodhidharma. This is just something arising. This is an intimate moment of care between two people. Does that make sense? So isn't it cool how you can sort of see it on both levels? Like, oh, that's what's going on here. There's actually a lot here. I want to be intimate with Bodhidharma. Stop thinking of him, but he can wash my feet. My ideas of him and what he was and how great he would be and how I can compare myself to him and how I fail or how he did it, that's maybe not so helpful. But maybe I can go into communion with him with soft hands and soft feet. Wow. Oh, there's something beautifully human about that. I also like that it seems to go from the spiritual realm to the human realm. You know, don't we just insist on thinking that this is all some sort of spiritual deal? That it's somehow lofty or somehow above us or somehow transcendent? It's always later. It's always, whoo, and it's never, whoo. It's always this. This is that. So it's a beautiful verse. So here's your chance, Bodhidharma. I mean, come on, man. Show up. Show up, you barbarian. Get on your knees and wash those feet. Wash those feet. See how that is. It's time to do something. It's time to do something. Enough of you being an idea. It's time to do something in form. That's how emptiness shows up for us. That's what the Heart Sutra teaches us. That's how emptiness shows up. Form. The podium. The words, the page, your body, the cloth against your skin, form. The bicycle you rode here on, form. The fog, form. Which is cool because it helps us to remember that emptiness is immediate, emptiness is visceral, emptiness is alive, and it feels, and it hears, and it hurts, and it loves, and it's you. It is not an idea. It is not an idea. It also is an idea, but it also isn't, you know? The doctrine of emptiness, we call it. Well, yeah, that's true. Sure, it's a doctrine. We talk about it as an idea, fine. But now we're distancing ourselves from it. It's you. It is the experience of your breath in your body right now. It's the words hitting your eardrum. It's the fears and hopes that live inside your heart. So a couple weeks ago, I saw my massage therapist. I see her about once a month. I've been seeing her for years. And she never speaks during the session. She's endlessly endlessly friendly and very chatty, actually, both before and after. But during the 90 minutes, and every once in a while I open my eyes and sneak a peek, because it almost looks like she's in a trance. She sort of looks like she's in a trance. Her eyes are usually closed, and she's doing all sorts of stuff, myofascial release or cranial sacral or moving, you know, deep tissue or whatever it feels like. She just follows her intuition and works on the form that shows up before her, right? Skin, flesh, bones, and marrow is what shows up before her, and she goes into that and finds areas of suffering, constriction, holding pain, and helps to facilitate release, helps to facilitate movement. Right? It's beautiful. So a couple weeks ago, you know, we're about halfway into the session, and we're deep into silence, and I'm just experiencing this happening, and she did something she's never done before, which was she leaned down. I forget where she was. I want to say my shoulder. No, it wasn't. It was in my knee. She leaned down a little closer than she normally would be, and she whispered to my body. And she said, "You survived. You're safe." And then she kept on working. Isn't that interesting? She was talking to my tissues. She wasn't talking to what I think of as me, as if those things could be separate. But she realized, oh, something's stored in here. You don't think you're going to make it. You're in peril. You think you're in peril. You think you're in danger. And so she's reminding it, oh, it's okay. You made it. This is really, really old. I don't know if it's 5 years old or 10 years old or if that happened when I was 2, or I have no idea what she was doing. But isn't that interesting? And when she said that, I had a powerful emotional response. The thing I call me had a powerful emotional response, as if somehow that was separate from what was being told to my tissues. But I was like, wow, I needed to hear that. I didn't know that on some weird level, subconsciously, I was afraid of not making it. Some part of me was still, right, hanging on to something. Isn't that interesting how we do this? What I liked about that was, wow, ignoring this body, ignoring form, is delusion. How awake can I be if I do not know that the form in front of me is holding huge suffering, is holding pain, is holding memories, is holding anguish, is holding... I have to free that. It is mine. It is also everybody's. It belongs to everybody. That's my job as a bodhisattva. That's the bodhisattva vow, to transform suffering. You see a being, you free it. Is it suffering? You help it. That's what you do. Wow, emptiness showed up as form. It showed up as suffering in form, and she helped to move something there. Wow, I needed to hear that. You survived. You're safe. So as I was leaving that day, I said, thank you for saying that. And she said, yeah, I don't know where that came from. And I was like, yeah, me neither, man. That was great. But I really had because it was so visceral, you know, it was so precognitive, it was so body, I thought, I can't, you know, there's 7.5 billion people on this planet. I bet you 7.5 billion out of 7.5 billion need to be told, you survived, you're safe. You know, I think everybody. And I was like, yeah, that probably makes perfect sense. We could say that to every client, every single time for the rest of your life, and those words would never stop being alive and helpful. So where I'm going with this is the practice of Zen, the practice of Buddhism, the way we do it, involves seeing what's happening in consciousness, feeling what's happening in consciousness, and then beginning to understand it, to begin to transform it, to begin to befriend it, to begin to, right? So we have to recognize first, we have to see first, and then we can feel before we can actually understand, before we can actually transform. The feeling has to come before the understanding and the transformation. And we're so quick, maybe it's just this culture, I don't know, maybe it's a human thing, but we're so quick to want to skip that part. We really want to skip the feel part. I want to read books about Zen. I want to get ideas about Zen. I want to sit Zazen, which is a mental activity somehow, I think. I don't know why I think that, but somehow if I could control my thoughts, I could control my perception of reality, and I could attain enlightenment. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Then I never have to deal with all the crap that is stored inside this body and is stored inside this heart that is still in so much pain, that still lives from a place of so much fear, so much shame, so much old. It's like, wow, no. I don't know how we got that idea. It was never that. From the very, very, very beginning, the Buddha was like, mindfulness of body and emotion. Mindfulness of body and emotion. So it's mental? No, mindfulness of body and emotion. What do I think about? Mindfulness of body and emotion. Well, but you must not mean the emotions that hurt, right? We can kind of skip those. Mindfulness of body and emotion. Isn't that funny? He was given that incredibly simple medicine as like, this is going to help you suffer less. And we don't want it, because in the moment, it involves us turning toward the thing we're trying to escape from. Please pay attention to form. I like the emptiness part. It's way trippier. I know. Guess what? The really trippy emptiness is your pain. It's your body. It's your, right? Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. You can't escape this. Go into it. Go into it. Go into it. So we love our abstractions. We love our ideas. We love our thorns. We love our briars. That's funny. We do. But we do. I'm no different. Because actually, now that I'm thinking about it, when I was driving away from the office, the massage therapist's office that day, I thought, wow, everybody should hear that. What a beautiful thing she said. And then I did what I'm really good at doing, you guys. Ego showed up and went, how come you didn't know that? Like, how come she found it? It's your body. How did you not know? And I was like, oh, yeah, geez, I'm bad at this. Yes, you are bad. Oh, yeah, okay. Hi, critic. You want to punch in? No, you can sit in the passenger seat, but you cannot drive. I encourage you to develop an affectionate and very firm relationship with your inner critic. Take it out when it's needed, which is about 5 minutes a year. And the rest of the time, passenger seat. Or glove compartment, depending. Okay, so I've wandered again. Bodhidharma is encouraged to wash our feet because we need to do something. The living energy of emptiness is activity. It is form. It shows up here. It shows up here. This is the way we are called to manifest our understanding. Before we have understanding, we have to feel. But once we understand, oh, this is what this is. Not complete understanding. Incomplete is fine. But I'm called to go into motion. I'm called to go into action. To care for suffering happens on the cushion, just with attention itself, working with thoughts and emotion, with body, with mind. But it's also off the cushion. And that's also body and emotion and thoughts and mind. But it includes activity. So we are asked to be, to use our bodhisattvas, as archetypes, we are called to be Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, to genuinely hear, to genuinely feel the suffering of the world. It's arising in our bodies moment after moment. It is not suffering. It is not separate from the suffering of anybody else. We are called to see it. We are called to name it, recognize it, feel it. Right? That's what Avalokiteshvara means, the regarder of the cries of the world. And this is not a regarding from a safe distance. And it's easy for us to do that. Oh, you poor dears. That's not compassion, folks. That's pity. And that's a very different thing. So, of course, we are called upon to recognize, to see, oh, this is suffering. I see this rising in me. And I'm going to embrace that feeling and help transform it with the kind awareness that I have developed on the cushion to the best I can, to the capacity I have today. But it doesn't end there because we're also asked to be Jizo. You guys know Jizo Bodhisattva, most of you, I assume? He's he, she, I don't know, they show up however they need to, but primarily he with him, I guess, more often. Still an embodiment, an archetype, a bodhisattva of compassion, but this is engaged compassion. This is rolling up the sleeves and getting in there and getting dirty and going down into hell for people and cooking them food when they're sick and sweeping their floors. He's compassion, but he's engaged compassion. And that's another talk for another day. Very, very powerful figure. Kasitagarbha in Sanskrit, but Jizo in Japanese. And Jizo is way easier to say. So I always think of Jizo. Plus, it's hard not to think of Jizo as being like Jesus' Italian cousin or something. Because they sound so much the same, and they're both super helpful, and they both help the poor, and they're both really wise and kind. I don't know. That's the Catholic boy in me. So to do something, to roll up the sleeves, to be engaged. So enlightenment, the nature of enlightenment, we think, oh, enlightenment is an experience that I have, probably on a cushion, probably during Rohatsu. right? That's the Zen myth. I have it on the cushion. I have it during a really long session, and it's really intense, and then everything falls away, and oh, I have this amazing experience, and that's a thing called enlightenment. Oh, that's what I want. That sounds really good, right? There's a degree of truth to that. But we add a lot of other stuff. We add the idea that, number one, if it shows up, it won't leave. That's hilarious. But we do that. Well, if that happened, all my problems go away. My relationship problems, my job problems, my mother-in-law. Wow. They would either go away or I just wouldn't experience them as afflictive anymore because I've attained enlightenment. You can come and wash my feet. It's not an experience. Enlightenment is not an experience. Enlightenment is action. Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. That totally changes the way we think of enlightenment. Are you enlightened right now? You have a chance to be. Will you be in another 5 minutes? That's a totally different deal. But to imagine, oh, there's a person who has this quality, and they are abiding and existing through time. That is an enlightened person. They therefore arrived there at some point, and therefore will carry that forward because that's the way reality works. No, oh my God, why would you think that? That's against everything we ever talk about in Buddhism, right? It's not an abiding state. What would an abiding state even look like? Have you ever had an experience that arose and didn't leave? Ever? Ever? A thought that didn't leave? An emotion that didn't leave? A physical sensation that didn't leave? An experience on the cushion that didn't leave, an experience off the cushion that didn't leave. You've never been in a traffic jam that didn't sooner or later stop. Well, enlightenment's just a traffic jam, you guys. And if it shows up, lovely, you had a great experience. And now it's time to do the dishes. And now it's time to take a step. And now it's time to call your mother-in-law. Right? Reality keeps showing up. So enlightenment is responsive. It is responsive. It is not dull. It's not abstract. It isn't hazy or blurry. It is sharp. It is as sharp as this moment. You feel your body right now. You feel your breath right now. The cloth against your skin right now. You have your thoughts and your emotions. You're hearing these words now. It's sharp. It is responsive. It's dynamic. It's immediate. It's clear. Right? Isn't it luminous, the clarity of this moment? Are you experiencing it? Can you ever experience it again? Whoosh. Right? Wow. Wow, it's doing something. It's form. It's emptiness. It's now. Wow. So it's engagement. It's never withdrawal. When we imagine enlightenment as being some place that we would go or an experience we would have that would forever keep us safe, that's about withdrawal, isn't it? That's actually saying no in a weird way. Like, no, it's too much. I can't handle it. I can't handle it. No. I want to stay in bed. Maybe enlightenment's like that. No, it's much more dangerous than that. You know, enlightenment's insanely dangerous. You move toward it, move toward it. Here it is arising now. Wow, what are you going to do? Are you going to shield yourself? No. Do you notice armor coming up around you? Wow, drop it. You notice the critic coming up? Back into the glove compartment. You have to go forward. Clear, 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 right? You recognize the filter, you drop it. There it is. Wow. So I'm encouraging action. Do something, do something, do something. And another way of saying this is actually don't do something helpful. Be help. Just be help itself. Be help itself. Don't think, I'm a normal person, I'm now going to do something helpful, and it'll take this amount of time, and then I'll go back to being a person. No. That's a separation. Be help. You are help. Right? Buddhism teaches us the nature of your awareness is compassion itself. That's what you actually are. Just remember, there is a way of doing the dishes that helps all beings. There is. There's a way of walking that where your footsteps kiss the earth. Have you experienced that? You get to do that. There's a way of taking in a breath that just says, abundance, thank you, overwhelmed, gratitude, humility. Wow, is that not enlightened activity? How is it distant from you? Be help, be help, be help. And when you find yourself not being help, encourage yourself to go back again. But, you know, maybe when you find yourself pulling back from being helpful, there's pain there. I don't feel like I have anything to offer right now. Right? We get smaller when we're in pain. So there you've got something to do. There's something that needs your help. You. Hi. Oh, are you still hurting? Okay. I'll sit with you. I'll remind you. You survived. You're safe. Here I am. Oh, the heart starts to open again. The mind starts to soften again. Now I'm engaged. Was I ever not engaged? No. I was engaged out at what I think is out there, and then I was engaged with what I think is in here. But no difference. No difference. So do something. And maybe it looks like something tangible. And during these times, for a lot of us, doing something tangible feels really good. It meets our need to feel powerful, to feel like we have some agency, to feel like we have some influence. I encourage you to do those things. They're a gift to you. They're also a gift to the world. But do the thing that you've debated doing. You know, donate the money to the charity you've thought about, or go to the peace rally you've thought about going to, or write a letter to your congressperson about gender inequality, or mass incarceration, or hold the door for somebody, or smile at a stranger, or sign a petition, or go to a march, or bring up environmental issues at your office party, you know, or talk about homophobia when you're with your family. Do it. See what it feels like. And care for what arises. Be very kind with what arises. And the important thing here, at least for me, because I get frozen around this stuff, is dare to do it imperfectly. I think that's hugely important. For a long, long, long time, I was frozen around social stuff, and especially around family, because I was like, how would Thich Nhat Hanh do this? Oh, yeah, that's what he would say. There's no way I could say that. So I won't say anything. Right? I know I'm not alone in this. Like, if I cannot do this perfectly, I cannot do this. And so, God, just do it badly. Right? I love the saying, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. I think that is genius. I honestly think there is what puts the critic in its proper place. You're doing it badly. Yes, I know, and I'm doing it. Right? There's not a person in the world who picks up a flute and can play it perfectly. You have to agree that playing the flute is valuable enough that you're going to play it very, very poorly for a long time. Right? Isn't that cool? I value this enough that I'm just going to be god-awful miserable at it for year after year after year. Doesn't that sound like every relationship you've ever been in? Like, I love you so much, I'm going to do my best, but man, I am going to absolutely screw this up day after day after day, and I'm going to show up, and it's going to be a failure, and I'm going to continue to forget what you asked me to do, and my breath is going to continue to be god-awful in the morning, and I'm going to continue to forget, and I'm going to show up again and try and try and try, because this is so worth doing. My heart is so into this. My heart isn't into anything else, actually. But what it loves, and it has to dare to do these things badly. So, our action doesn't have to be perfect. Our action, and this is a cool thing, it is. It is, right? I mean, to practice the flute is to play the flute, folks. You can't practice the flute without playing the flute. So it isn't like, oh, I practice and practice and practice, and then someday I learned how to play it. Like, what? That's actually not possible. There isn't a difference between playing and practicing. Practicing is to play it. That's how you do. So to practice Oryoki, to practice Zazen, to practice is to do. Practice enlightenment. That's why Dogen says practice enlightenment. These are not two things. You don't practice Zen until you enlighten Zen. This is that. They are not two things. You sit down on the cushion, and there it is. It's a mark you cannot miss. It's a mark you cannot miss. It's your life. Wow. So, please don't let your concern, personal, social, global, be detached. Let it be personal. Practice is personal. Politics are personal. Religion is personal. Science is personal. It's all personal. Can you imagine something that isn't actually personal? We like the idea of impersonal. It's helpful for us sometimes. But we experience. The truth is, we experience. Right? We experience. It is personal. The only mind you will ever know is your own. It is the mind. It is your mind. It is personal. All of this that we call reality, and we break it up into categories called science and religion and interpersonal stuff and politics, it's personal. It's arising in your mind. It is personal. And so we can't let our aspirations, our lofty ideals, our fixation on some sort of ultimate freedom obscure our necessary call for working toward relative freedoms, for working in the world of form, for working toward imperfect solutions using this imperfect life. And please also don't impose the idea of this sort of terminal individualism. We're very fond of in this country, I'm fond of it too, that somehow my actions impact mostly me alone. We've spent the last 8 weeks, we're done now, but we just spent 8 weeks in practice period exploring the ideas of impermanence and interdependence and empowerment. and learning, everything we do matters. Everything we do matters. Everything we do matters. So, wow, it does become personal, doesn't it? The results of my zazen don't stop. The results of my angry words don't stop. I'm engaged, you guys. I'm in this. So are you. We don't have a choice. We're in this. We're in this. It matters. It matters. Non-action is a choice. Action's a choice. They can both be wise. Right? There is a way to understand interconnectedness as liberative, as supportive. As supportive. Interconnectedness. Whoosh, there it is. There it is. Somebody needs her and she goes. So the ripples never stop. I'm going to end with a story. I got this in an email from one of my teachers. I'll call her that. She's right now in South Africa. I shared this story with the practice period folks. And she wrote, "Today we went to a place where the first Homo sapien remains are found. 52 caves by the cliffs on the north, or on the ocean just south of Nizhna in Mosul Bay." Nizhna is a small town in the southwest, western part of South Africa. "It was incredibly touching. We held stone tools that were once crafted and held by humans 165,000 years ago. When we entered the cave, the guide said to us, 'Welcome home.' So the ripples of those stone tools didn't stop. And she held them, and then her words touched me, and now they're touching you. And they won't stop with you. And they didn't start with those stone tools. This is emptiness. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And here's why I like this. I don't want to get fixated on Bodhidharma, and I also am crazy about Bodhidharma. He's in the men's changing room downstairs, so every time I open the door, he's there glaring at me. I'm like, oh yeah, you're just so cranky, sweetheart. I want to make you smile at least once. But I don't want to get fixated on him because that's not what Zen is. And I like the stone tools story because you know what it reminds me of is, yeah, I'm an American provisionally, but before that my ancestors were Irish, and before that they were, and before that they were, and before that, and if I go back far enough, I'm African. And you know what? Even that's made up. Africa? That's a word. We made it up. That continent didn't used to always look like that, didn't used to be part of that, it used to be something else. There wasn't a beginning. How could there be? And so this thing that I do that I love so much called Zen, it isn't Japanese. Why would I think it's Japanese? It's not Japanese. And it wasn't Chinese before that. And it wasn't Indian before that. There's no ancestor who carries these things to us as if they're commodities, as if they're fixed, as if it's like a precious bowl or something that doesn't change. And Zen isn't American now. How could it be? I don't like thinking of our forms, and I don't like thinking of this tradition as a cultural trapping, because it distances me from them. It makes me feel like an outsider, and I'm not an outsider, and neither are you. You're the one who's sitting right now in this room. This is where Zen is coming alive. Right now. It wasn't before in Japan, or before in China, or before when Buddha was around in India. Now. 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 Right? That's not how I actually experience them. I don't feel them in my heart as being distant, or as being cultural, or as being alien to me. They show up because they're human. That's why I recognize them. I'll recognize stone tools. I'll recognize these things. They are mine. They're human. Anything human should not be stranger to me. We're all human. These things show up as alive for us because we can touch them, because they aren't abstractions, because we aren't holding them at arm's length. We don't come here to pretend that we're something different than we are. And I like to think that my life exists within the realm of relativity, that yes, my passport says America, and I come to Zen Center and I take off my shoes, which is a Japanese cultural thing, and I put on these clothing that I guess you could argue are Chinese, and I guess you could argue this comes from India. But I like to remind myself, my life is also taking part outside of all of those things. Outside of all of those things. And before I attach my little distinctions, there's something vast happening. The gentle breeze pervades the universe. It isn't mine. The breath isn't mine. I just borrow it for a second and then I release it again. So Zen is just Zen. And bowing is just bowing. And bowing isn't a Japanese thing or a Chinese thing or an Indian thing or an American thing. It's just human. It's just a human thing. Walking, it's a human thing. breathing, eating, laughing, crying. These things can't exist apart from us. We give them life. And we give them life now. That's where they're alive now. And that's where I encourage you to find them. So remember, please, as I finish today, as you go into your day, what you take from this is your own. I don't have an opinion about what you take from this, but I would encourage you to at least engage the idea that a very inherent, essential, core part of you goes beyond all distinctions, beyond gender, race, national, country of birth, beyond continents, beyond politics, beyond life and death. That before you were all those things, your consciousness, right? This is going back to what we call original self. And it shows up for us today on this Sunday as just human, simple, alive, awakeness itself wrapped right now in this soft, sensitive skin, arms, legs, a fiercely beating heart that somehow remembers that it did survive. It is safe. And it's here, and it's your life, and it's full, and it's whole, and it's ready, and it's offering. Thank you very much.